Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Day Beautiful. I'm Adam Vitkavage, and this is a podcast where I interview a debut author about their reading and writing history, what inspires them, their debut book from Genesis to editing it, and from querying agents to finally selling it. If you like what you hear here, check us out on daybeautiful.net and follow us on social media at daybeautiful. Today's guest is a Harvard-trained cultural psychologist, Pushcart-nominated fiction writer, and first-generation American. Her work and writing have appeared in HuffPost, Chicago Tribune, Catapult, Salon, The Wall Street Journal, The Rumpus, and much more. Her debut novel, The Band, is out now. Please welcome Christine Mock-Kellums. Now, Christine, I just read your official bio, but I'm curious, what is your unofficial bio? Who is Christine?
Gosh, it's so hard to answer, but I don't know. I guess I would say I'm like a first generation American who loves chocolate covered gummy worms. I live in LA, so I'm like an Angeleno, and yeah. I do a lot of things for fun, but I'm sure we'll get into all of that later.
Yeah, definitely. No, the gummy worms was most important. I'm glad you brought that up. super, super important. I want to start with, before we dive into the band, into your novel, your bio on your website, where it's like written in first person, it's a little longer than like an official blurb bio. Mm-hmm. The first paragraph is about how, I'll just read it. Because this is, I just love this. My father, fresh out of China's Cultural Revolution, moved there to Puerto Rico, thinking that it was the 51st state. It said U.S. territory on the atlas, to acquire a magical string of initials behind his last name. And then you go on to talk about how, like, degrees from the Caribbean as an Asian isn't necessarily sought after in America. And I'm just like, I just want to start there with your childhood and what it was like for you and your parents figuring things out.
Yeah, I mean, as hard as it was for me, I almost feel like I got like the easy end because I was just a kid, right? So I was dealing with stuff that I think most kids, like every kid who's ever been to a new school, probably dealt with some maybe like lesser version of what I dealt with. And I feel like my parents got the brunt of it, because even like now that I'm an adult with children of my own, I cannot imagine like moving to a new country where I do not know the language and you are not making enough money to live off of, and like trying to navigate that while providing a semi-normal childhood. So, I mean, for me, I think when I look back at it, I feel like it's a marvel that I can write in English now, because it took me so long just to pick up the language. And like, you know, like I teach now, and I, you know, my spouse is also a teacher, and to think that like between the ages of like 5 and 10, I just could not function in any language, because like I spoke Chinese at home, but then like in Puerto Rico, everyone spoke Spanish, and like my parents didn't know that either. So we literally landed like having no idea that Spanish was the official language. Yeah. How my dad like ended up graduating with a PhD, like having not spoken the language. And then, so like not being able to speak Spanish, but then when we moved to the mainland, like to the Midwest, and everyone spoke English, it's a whole nother transition. So I'm like, I don't think it's normal for someone to take 5 years to eventually figure out how to speak a language when they're totally immersed. But that it really, I think it took that long because it was just one unexpected sort of jarring change after another. But I think that also gives me a lot of appreciation for things like, you know, movement and immigration and like change, and like even using language as this thing that, you know, grounds us and that like changes our sense of reality almost. So as an adult, I can appreciate it. As a child, you know, looking back, I feel like it was probably very traumatic.
Yeah, I am just blown away by that story, like the brief part, like the bio, like explaining, and even just you telling it now, because it's just like, I think a lot of Americans now just think of like the immigrant story of, you know, just coming straight to America and not hitting, like speaking Spanish first, like learning Spanish and then English, you know. It's like, wow, I just commend you and your family. I just think that's so amazing that everything, you know, I just think it's so cool. And was writing and reading a big part of your life during these massive, not only like local moves, but language moves?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think And I think it expands beyond just writing, because it took me a long time to figure out even like how to write a sentence in English, right? Because of all the changes and all the moving. But I think like stories more broadly. So I don't know if this gets talked enough about, but I feel like when I was a kid and I was an immigrant, and my parents included, like we figured out how to be in America by watching like stuff on TV. Like we didn't have the money to go to the movies, but like we could turn on the TV and like through those kinds of stories, we like figured out like we learned English that way. Like my mom and I literally learned English by watching Golden Girls. And like a lot of our sense of what it means to like be an American and use this language just came through like the stories we saw on like the silver screen. And so these days when I think about storytelling, I don't think about just like books. I think about like all mediums of storytelling. Because I feel like they're all sort of interchangeable, and there's so much like prestige to me now that's like come out of even like novels, which I'm really excited by. I feel like it's almost all like the same, which is cool.
Was so this book deals a lot with like music culture, and we'll get to I'll ask about the band in a second, but I'm curious about, you know, storytelling was a big part of your life. Was music always a part of it?
You know what? It wasn't like I feel really guilty saying this. But like I listened to music a lot, just like pop music, like top 40 a lot when I was like a teenager and when I was younger. But then like as an adult, I'm not one of like I have friends who like are diehard music fans or musicians who like follow bands, go to concerts. And I don't know if it was just a socioeconomic thing. Like I think I went to my first concert. I was like that I actually paid for, maybe in like graduate school or like like after I was married and like settled, like when I was like truly an adult in my late 20s, I think I bought like my first concert tickets because like growing up, like no one had that kind of expensive income. And like even CDs and stuff, like I feel like it's sort of expensive. So I just never like radio was my primary way of like listening to music, which is a very sort of limited set. And so I feel like I was a very late comer to discovering a love of music, including things like K-pop. Like I discovered way late. So yeah, I don't think I was a lifelong like music connoisseur by any stretch of the imagination. It's just sort of a something I've de like developed more as an adult now that I have the free time and the expendable income to do it.
No, I feel you. I think music is it was weird for me. I was very into it in high school, going to see like local bands play for $5 at like someone's house or whatever. That was who I was, like the dirty music scene kid. And then now it's like I do like listen to music and I make a lot of playlists, like get myself through the day. But I think I think this is one of those things where I don't know if it's actually true, but years and years ago, I heard or saw a headline that was like, you stop listening to music when you turn like 33. And I don't know if
Oh,
that's true, but
really?
I've held it in my head forever, you know? And I'm 35 now, and it's like, yeah, there are bands I discover now, but for the most part, I'm listening to like the same three people over and over and over again, just because it's comfortable.
Yeah, I heard the same thing on like I think Tom Segura's podcast. He was like quoting something very similar where he was like, after a certain age, you just don't want to listen to new stuff anymore. I was like, I did not know that. Because I feel like I've just learning about new stuff in my, like advanced age now.
So you discovered K-pop, you said a little later than everyone else. Were you a fan of K-pop before? Well, let's just talk about the band and then I'll ask about K-pop. Could you pitch, what is the band about? Cut through the publicity copy. What would you pitch it to as like someone in the grocery store? Like you hold your book here, read this book.
I would say it's about a K-pop star who, right when he reaches like the peak of like global domination, ends up getting canceled over a like a silly song. And he ends up coming to America and trying to escape via a random therapist, like literally a rando he meets at the grocery store. And it's about how this sort of causes a spiral of like violent interactions and confrontations between like the band and their fandom.
And were you a fan of K-pop before you started the book, or did that come after like this all unfolding?
Me discovering K-pop essentially prompted me to write the book. Like it all happened fairly quickly. Like I discovered K-pop and then I started writing the band, and then it sort of just they sort of happened at the same time.
Yeah, perfect. That makes a lot of sense. And okay, let's talk about that. So the band, what you discover K-pop and you're like, I'm going to write about a K-pop megastar and a therapist? Or did you already have an idea for like a therapist talking to someone? I know with your background, maybe like, I thought that maybe came first, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I discovered K-pop and I was like, oh my God, this is like a whole new genre of music that, like, not just musically, but I feel like socio-politically is unlike anything I've seen before. Like, I remember, like, growing up as a kid, like, on the radio, like, NSYNC and Backstreet Boys and all these, like, boy bands of the 90s and early aughts were really big. So I remember that era and that culture. And I thought I was, like, and I think that's part of the reason I resisted K-pop, because I was like, oh, I'm too old. Like, I'm not a teenager anymore. I'm not in college anymore. Like, I'm too old to, like, to discover fangirl over anything. Like, I have a job, I have kids, like, I don't have time for this. So I just, like, resisted it. But then, you know, eventually it became so mainstream that I was like, I have to know what the excitement is about. And I discovered, I was like, oh, it's totally different. Like, it's not just, like, your regular, like, American boy band. It's, like, a whole nother sort of system and, like, universe in itself. And then I discovered, like, the K-pop fandoms and how unique and how invested, dedicated they were. And I think that was actually what prompted me more than anything, in that, like, the fandom was this, like, entire universe where, like, they had, like, they weren't just bound together by their, like, love of these, you know, bands, but they were bound together by causes too. Like, they would synergistically get together. And this was right around, like, the 2020 elections as well, when, like, BTS armies, for example, were doing all kinds of disruptive things to the Trump campaign. I was like, oh my God. Like, I couldn't imagine being, like, an NSYNC fan and, like, getting involved politically as a teenager. Yeah. But now seeing these fandoms getting involved politically, like, I was just really blown away and impressed. So that's sort of where the idea came from, like, thinking how these interactions could play for both good and evil in a, like, a fictional universe.
Yeah, I don't listen to K-pop. I have heard songs, I've seen videos. My sister really loves K-pop. She's older than me, and it is, and all my friends who do listen to it, and it's just, you're right, it is a different ecosystem. It's like a completely different world, which is great. I love that there's, like, passionate people out there about whatever, because I feel like we're so apathetic. I mean, especially maybe I think we still are a little apathetic about a lot of things, but I think now people actually care because we saw, like, what could happen when you don't care about things unfold. But yeah, it's just wild. So you mentioned 2020 is when you started thinking about this. That's a pretty quick turnaround for a debut. I've heard debut writers talk about, like, took 10 years, 15 years. 4 years is quick.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to pretend like I'm just that efficient, because I've written other things that, like I wrote a whole novel before I wrote a band.
We'll dive into that in a second.
So yeah, like, it's not like I'm just that good at writing very fast. But I think the band itself, it was also 2020 when we were, like, all stuck inside. So I had a lot of, like, just time indoors, like, not commuting to work, just staying. And this is so, I wrote the book in, like, a matter of a couple of months in 2020, I think, or maybe it bled into 2021. Like, my entire time, sense of time around the pandemic is fuzzy, because I'm like, I can't remember when things started and stopped. It all sort of blends together. But yeah, it was a relatively, like, once I started writing, it was a relatively quick turnaround. And, you know, it's not a long book, so it's on the short end as far as novels go. So that probably also helped that I didn't write that much.
Yeah, the book that is not out that you wrote, and it's tucked away maybe forever. Not what was it about, but what was the difference between that and the band? Why did the band click for you?
I think the band was just a more, I guess, like, potentially, like, commercially appealing premise. So, I mean, I think, like, you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, but, like, you know, publishing at the end of the day is also a business. So I think that, like, depending on how you pitch your projects, like, you get different responses, right? So the book that I wrote before the band, it was a little bit more literary, it was a little slower, and it wasn't quite, like, connected to a pop cultural phenomenon the way, like, the band is K-pop connection. So I think that's probably why I sold the band first and before, like, that other book came to be, because it's just, culturally speaking, I think it's much more, like, sellable almost because of the K-pop connection.
Definitely. And part of Day Beautiful is I go way out of order. I don't have a timeline. So we're going to jump back in time now because you have written two books then. One is being published, one is out there somewhere, maybe just in a drawer. You have a degree in Spanish. You are a psychologist by day. You also write, though. How did, when, why, how did you have these two like careers, like fiction and psychology?
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to write. That was like no question. Like even as a kid who like could not, put a sentence together in English, like I knew I wanted to be a writer. But I think also like anyone with Asian parents might understand. I was like, there's no way in like it was not an option. Like it was like the equivalent of me saying like I want to go to the moon. Like it was just not in the realm of possibility to ever say to my parents like I want a creative career.
Yeah.
So psychology seemed like this like. Not to say that I don't like psychology. I love psychology. It's just like psychology seems like this almost nice compromise where in psychology, you don't tell stories necessarily, but you do study human nature. And I feel like in my when I read and when I write, I'm almost always like trying to understand why people do the things that they do. And I feel like stories do that for us in a similar way that like empirical studies about people do it for us, just in using like different formats. So like even in something like writing, about, whatever, like K-pop or something else. Like, I think the goal in a lot of storytelling and the reason I love a lot of books is like it either makes me feel less alone, right? Like, because it makes me like understand something better and be like, oh, like this is a universal human experience, even if it's super idiosyncratic and specific, or it's totally brand new and it opens my eyes to a world that I just didn't know existed. And I feel like I'm transported and I know something and my world has expanded, right? So either way, I feel like we're learning something either about ourselves or about, part of the world. And I think psychology tries to do the same thing. So that was sort of like the compromise in my head that I'm like, the way I'm trying to like unpack people and just do it through science or do it through like a good story.
Yeah, and your first short story for fiction that at least is on your website was 2016. But then you also write about empirical studies on culture for numerous outlets across the world. The two parts of your brain, can you do them in the same day? What does this look like for you when it's like I got to write for GQ in Australia, or I'm going to write this weird short story about whatever? Can you do both in the like?
Luckily, it doesn't usually happen at the same time. So, like for example, like when I publish an empirical study, and also the strategies and the approach are totally different. So
Yeah.
I think that's why like debuting as an author feels like such a new experience, even though I've technically like written academic books before. It's because like whenever like I've written anything academic or empirical, I just do the science and then I, write the article and then I, work with my collaborators. But once it's out there, like I don't actually have to do any publicity for science. I just sort of sit around and like sometimes like GQ Australia will just pick up the story and I don't even like at most they ask me for a sentence or two. Like I don't have to do anything. Like they find me rather than I'm like pitching them. And so but for like writing fiction, it's totally different where I feel like book publicity is like very much like in your own hands as an author. Like obviously publishing houses do a lot, but also I feel like now more than ever, authors are also expected to like maintain an online presence where they're like pitching people or putting themselves out
Yeah.
there. So yeah, like luckily the timelines are not the same. Like I'm still working on empirical studies these days, but like the further along I feel like you get in your career as an academic, the more collaborators you have. So most of my projects now are like multi-site studies with a bunch of other collaborators who, again, like are doing a lot of the work. So I'm not like single-handedly
Sure.
doing most of it myself. So luckily for me, I'm usually not like both trying to figure out a short story or like the next novel while also figuring out how to like get my, empirical stuff
Yeah.
out. Same time, like on the same day, usually not. Usually,
Yeah.
like my days, where some days I focus just on like school stuff and academic stuff, and other days I focus just on like writing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird balance to strike because it's like two vastly different careers, you know. But you're doing it and you're still doing it, which is amazing. Like you just published something. I guess now you're writing a lot of nonfiction essays about like K-pop, like gearing up for this book. How is that going for you?
It's a lot of fun. Like, I like writing in general. Like, so I like nonfiction writing almost as much as I like fiction writing. And honestly, it's less work for me to write nonfiction. Like, I feel like fiction demands